This meeting is now being recorded.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the new GTLD Subsequent Procedure Subteam Track 3, String Contention Objections and Dispute, held on the 9th of January, 2018. In the interest of time, there'll be no roll call. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room only. If you're only on the audio bridge, could you please let yourselves be known now? Hearing no names, I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for a recording purpose, and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll turn it back over to the co-chair, Karen Day. Please begin.
Thank you, Terry. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening and good middle of the night for those of you in the APAC region. Thank you for making the effort to join us today. Hope everyone's new year has gotten off to a good start. And first of all, my condolences to Christina and any other Georgia Bulldogs that happen to be on the call today. Today we're going to be doing our third pass of the objection topic, specifically legal rights objections and string confusion objections. First, we will go over our agenda and make sure, see if anyone has anything to add, and then we will jump right in. First, we'll do our normal call for any updates anybody needs to make us aware of on SOIs. We will call on our co-chair of the plenary to give us an update there. We had a meeting of the full group yesterday. We will then do look at the legal rights objection, then the string confusion objection. Then if the hour is up, which I'm guessing it will be, we will review our next steps and action items and then any other business, and we'll talk about our next meeting. Does anybody have anything they want to add to the agenda, any other business they want to add, anything they want to revise? Anybody need to switch up the order of the agenda for timing reasons? Not seeing any hands. I will move along to the second item there and ask if anybody has an update to their statement of interest that they need to let us know about at this time. Okay, not seeing any hands, not seeing any comments in the chat. We will then assume everybody has been stable with their employment over the holidays, which is a good thing. Let's see here. I see Cheryl is on the call with us. Cheryl, could you hop on and give us an update from the plenary and where we are and what we need to be paying attention to these days?
Thanks, Karen. Happy to do so. Very briefly, I can't even work out how many hours ago, but about 12-ish, we had our plenary call. And we looked at – are you able to hear me? Yep, must be able to. We looked at our predictability framework and the homework that that we had set ourselves before the holiday break, and again, we looked at the classifications or the need or otherwise for categories and classifications or classes, and furthered our discussion there. One of the things we've asked people to think about is if they've got any suggestions for actual cases, not for us to specifically try and discuss the issues, but rather to use as sort of stress tests to go up against the predictability framework, and so that's an additional piece of ongoing homework. Other than that, we just reminded everybody about the three of our five works track calls that are going on this week. Yep, that's about it for me. Thanks. It is one of the APAC people here, the middle of the night for me, so if I've skipped anything, I'm sure Steve or staff will pick me up and pop into chat. Over to you.
Thank you, Cheryl. Appreciate it, and appreciate the middle of the night wake-up call for you. Anyone have any questions for Cheryl, I, or staff about the plenary before we move on in? I believe there was a Work Track 1 call late last night, early this morning, depending on your time zone. There'll be Work Track 5 later in the week. All right, then, not seeing anything, let's move on down to legal rights objections. If we'll go on down, the slide deck is unsynced. Everyone can scroll for themselves down to slide 4. Thought we would start with a very quick high-level recap of our prior discussions on this topic, just as a very, again, high-level refresher. This was back in over a year ago, actually. This was December 2016. We were looking at this. We looked at the statistics around legal rights objections. There were some concerns identified with the policy language and the applicant guidebook language at the time. Some issues were raised regarding the scope of the objection, particularly related to the basis of the infringement, which requires providing usage, and that's sometimes difficult to do if you have a pending trademark application as opposed to a registered trademark. The intended purpose could be taken into account, but this would require that intentions are binding, and the potential ramifications, including a process to deal with changes in enforcement, et cetera, surrounding those intentions would be required. We also discussed a straw man that was presented to us of how we might look at this going forward. Paul McGrady took section 3222 of the applicant guidebook and did some redlining. The major change there, and we're going to go through it section by section, was changing the word, the term infringed to abused. Sort of broadens it out, and we had some pretty good discussion around that. We didn't come to agreement on whether or not that was going to be something we were going to move forward with or not. We also had questions about what exactly the problem was we were trying to solve by making this change. And so, again, we had some really good discussions on this back a year ago, but we did not come to consensus. And so what we want to do today, because we agreed at the time, the principle is relevant, and unless somebody speaks today and wants to say that they don't agree, the principle about the objections is good, but there was discussion about needing to change the implementation and the layout of that underlying principle, and so that's what this straw man, this redlining of the applicant guidebook, these two relevant sections did. And so we want to go through that today and see if we can start to head towards some agreement on whether or not these are changes we want to make, if there are changes we want to make. And I just want to give a just a reminder overall as we're sort of heading into the home stretch here that items that we don't reach consensus on now in this subsequent procedures will then, for subsequent procedures, be the same. So if we don't reach consensus on some type of change, then what was in place in 2012 will be in place going forward. So lack of consensus, in other words, means status quo. So with that, let's move on into the straw man itself. Let's see. Can we bring up the actual document, Emily, and the Steve, and the screen here? Okay. Yeah. And you can zoom in for yourself. And perhaps you have your copy on your desktop or printed otherwise. First thing here is this first in section 3222 here of the guidebook. There's a change from a rights holder to any rights holder. If anyone wants to speak to that change, I'm going to approach this today that if you agree with it, that you won't speak to it, and we're going to leave the change in. But if you want to object to the change or propose a different change, raise your hand or put in a comment. But then we get to the more significant one that people have said is an issue where we changed, the proposal is to change the word infringed to abused. And so let's have some discussion about that proposal what do we want to go, where do we want to go with this? And does anyone want to speak to that? I see a comment in the registry, Christina. Apologies, I'm behind. With the person who proposed any, please describe the purpose and the reason for it. This, Christina, unfortunately, the whole proposal was from Paul McGrady, and Paul has not joined us today. So we do have the audio and the transcript of the call back in December of 2016, when Paul Pert first presented that, on. He might, I don't know, I don't recall actually that particular one being questioned at the time, but Liz, I see Christina's asking if you might know Paul's rationale for that. Okay, see, John is proposing Paul having this discussion until Paul can be here. Jim is seconding that motion. Susan as well. Okay. Well, I'm going to defer to our plenary chair, Cheryl, and ask for a judgment. Unless, Liz, if you can speak for Paul and know his availability. I mean, this was advertised before Christmas. We sort of need to get through this. I mean, this proposal's been out here for a year, but... Cheryl, what do you think? Give me some guidance.
Thanks, Karen. Thanks, Karen. And I do note in the chat Christina's suggestion that you can use the time to identify questions and concerns. But I also think that there's probably some benefit, to say the least, as you pointed out, because of the fact that it was advertised, and of course whether or not one can guarantee any particular member to be attending at any specific time, why not continue on with a read-through on this? Note the question, for example, on this one, there is a desire to have Paul's specific rationale on the change of terminology here and on any other points that you want to carry on and specifically get back from Paul, but have the group discussion at least in a short order, if not in the full amount of time you had planned, to try and stick to your plan on your timing. I'm quite sure that this may not be the only point that you'll want to raise on the list in writing as an action item with Paul for him to respond. But I think there'd be great benefit for you to continue on with your planned agenda and simply make a note of things that you need his particular and specific clarifications on. That'd certainly be my first response anyway. Thanks.
Thanks, Cheryl. And that is my instinct. I felt like we were going to come out of this today with questions to go to the list. So if the rest of you are willing, I would like to go on with that, and we will absolutely note the first question on this change of a rights holder to any rights holder. All right. With regard to the change from infringed to abused, we spent a good, almost an entire call last time discussing that subject. Does anyone want to speak to that today and the pros and the cons of widening that from the more narrow legal term of infringed to the more, as some have said, nebulous term of abused? John says in chat he prefers to keep it as infringed. Anne, I see your hand. Please, go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Karen. It's Anne, and I'm merely speculating here in absence, but I do think that there are situations under various laws in various nations that could result in what you would say a wrongful conduct that is not necessarily, you know, called infringement. Some of the considerations that can enter in are, you know, if the use of the trademark is misleading and misleads consumers, technically speaking, it may not be referred to as infringement. It runs more along the lines of unfair competition and misleading consumers. There's also the whole area of the dilution, where dilution really isn't infringement per se, but it's about the dilution of a trademark is an actionable thing. I don't know if those items or what Paul was trying to get at or not. I just mentioned them in his absence. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. Christina, please go ahead.
Sure, Christina Rosette. I just wanted to flag that without getting into the merits of infringed versus abused at this point, which I think we, I will have to, I am going to go back and look at some of Paul's rationale. I just wanted to note that the discussion within the GNSO when the policy recommendations were made was very much focused on infringement. So to the extent that we decide that that discussion was not literal, and I think it would, someone would have to go back and check all the transcripts on it, I think we're going to need to be prepared to explain why we have changed, why we've decided to go with a different term, regardless of whether it's abused or violated or whatnot. So I just want to flag that as something that we'll need to cover, depending upon how this discussion about infringed versus abused plays out.
Thank you for that, Christina. Greg, please go ahead.
Thanks, it's Greg Chatton for the record. The reason I suggested violated is that, you know, typically in agreements and the like where I've dealt with this issue of what if it falls near infringement and is having, you know, a similar effect on legitimate rights holders' trademark, usually end up with kind of a little laundry list that says infringed, diluted, misappropriated, or otherwise violated. And so that seemed to indicate that these can all be put into a recognizable bucket called violated. Abused, I think, fits with some of the terminology we use in ICANN and everywhere else around domain name abuse. I don't know that grammatically it quite fits. I don't know that you necessarily abuse a domain name or be rather abuse a trademark. So at least you violate it and kind of comes closer. We could use the whole mini laundry list, infringed, misappropriated, diluted, or otherwise violated, and that might create a little more clarity for what people are talking about here, and you know, get rid of the nebulousness or ambiguity of abused or perhaps even violated. That would be, I think, my suggestion, not that I'm getting paid by the word or anything. Thanks.
Thank you, Greg. And just to help our note takers here, can you type into chat, because on a personal perspective, I quite like using the idea of using the list. It is short enough that provides clarity. But could you provide in chat, yeah, infringed, diluted, misappropriated, or otherwise violated? Okay. Thanks. Does anyone have any thoughts on that as a substitute for either infringed or abused? Is that set better than just abused? I see in the chat, Kurt says, this objection was always intended to be a narrow inquiry, focus on the string itself. It is difficult to extrapolate from a string name to infringement or abuse or misappropriate without some additional action, which occurs typically after the string is delegated. With such a narrow inquiry, I prefer the legal term infringement, which seems to have the clearest meaning. John Nevitt seems to be concurring with Kurt, says there is a body of law in infringement. Christina has a request of staff. Would it be possible to post a link to Paul's paper putting forward the straw man and rationale? Christina, there's... Okay. So, beyond this discussion in chat, Christina, unfortunately, Paul just submitted the red line. He did not submit a paper with rationale, as it were. He just emailed us the red line and then came on the call and talked to us. So we will have to get him on the call or go to him in writing with our questions. And Ann said, noted in the chat that she agrees with Greg that dilution and misappropriation go to the string itself. Okay. Does anyone else want to speak to this? We seem to be at sort of a 50-50 split here on those who are commenting on this, which would lead us to leave it where it is, but we will take it to the list and we will go back to Paul for some more clarity. All right. We'll have no more comments on this. Let's move on down and look at the rest of the red lines.
Hey Karen, Paul, this is Steve.
I'm sorry, Steve, I didn't see your hand. Please, go ahead.
Thanks, Karen. This is Steve Chan from staff. So I think Karen noted in the slides that the rationale for the switch from infringed to abused was that infringement is, and I think Kurt actually noted this in his comment, that it's difficult to prove infringement without the domain being delegated or, actions of the TLD being exhibited. So it seems like the conversation now is focused more on whether or not the words are appropriate, but I was wondering if it might be worth discussing whether the rationale for any type of switch from infringement to some other term, if there's agreement among the WorkTrack members for that, the purpose of making any type of switch. Thanks.
Thanks, Steve. Does anyone have any feelings on that? Yes, Greg, go ahead.
Thanks, Greg Chapman, again, for the record. I think Steve's hit the nail on the head in terms of the problem with infringement alone. If you go to the legal definition of infringement, at least under U.S. law, you end up having to perform a likelihood of confusion test, which is a 5-8 factor test, which in the absence of a delegation or a website may prove to be impossible to meet with legal rigor. So if this is an objection process, which is by necessity before anything exists, you either have to extrapolate into what the uses might be or make an argument that the under a likelihood of confusion test that the existence of the TLD causes infringement. I have not done the research to see how a likelihood of confusion test against a top-level domain would really work out. Maybe it works out fine if we've got some jurisprudence on that, and not just U.S. jurisprudence. But the concern is, that it's a kind of a test that involves use-based issues. So it may be that we're not using infringement in the narrow legal meaning, or kind of we're forecasting potentially what it would be if it were used, as opposed to looking at how it was used and whether it infringed in its use. That creates kind of another problem, because then we're not using infringement to mean what it really means, which is why some form of a broader list of things. And I agree with Kurt, that whatever we need to pick, it needs to go to the string. That is what is being objected to. But the string in context. So the issues, I think, are troublesome. We need to solve them. infringement is not necessarily difficult to prove. It's a question of what you need to prove it. And an applicant is going to say in its application what it intends to do, and that absolutely should, you know, be part of the basis of the application's any objections to that application. And in the case of certain strings, it's not difficult at all. You know, just look at Merck and Merck. It's clear that, you know, both of them were going after the same, essentially the same trademark, owned by different companies due to the, you know, history. So I don't see, you know, that's not the same thing as, say, Ping, which has, you know, a technical meaning that has nothing to do with the golf club company. So I still think, though, we need to look at whether infringement is the right kind of test to apply at this point, or the only kind of test, because we can't apply a test that, you know, isn't meetable on its face, because it's not aimed at addressing an issue at this point that a rights holder would have. Thanks.
Thank you, Greg. Just catching up on the chat, Christina said that she would be interested in hearing an explanation as to why abuse, dilution, violation, et cetera, don't raise the same issue as infringement. And then we have noted here in chat some other questions from Paul that we will get out to him and on the list regarding what took place in the 2012 round that might have prompted some of this. And Kurt notes that at this stage, the application process, we can't deny an application for what an applicant might do, which was the point of infringement, and it's being difficult to prove. All right. If we go on down, I think, into the further sections here of the AGB, I think we might get some more detail as to what Paul was getting at. There's more detail in these red lines, so let's move on down here and take a look at these next set of red lines and see if that helps inform our discussion some. Paul has suggested here that where the statement is, as you see, adding in or was filed for the purpose of triggering a private auction proceeding designed to obtain payment for the objector. And again, that's a question that Ann has asked in the chat of, do we know of examples of this in the 2012 round? I would ask if anyone knows of examples of this happening that's on the call today, could let us know. Otherwise, we'll put this out to the list and come back and have that discussion offline. But it does seem that that was something that Paul was aware of. I'm not seeing that anyone here seems to have been aware of that. All right. Then the next item number one, whether the applied for GTLD is identical, similar, or a translation or transliteration of, which is the additional text, including appearance, phonetic sound, or meaning to the objector's existing mark. So again, Paul is broadening out what was in item one here to include a translation or a transliteration. How does the membership feel about that broadening of that section? Do we feel comfortable with that? Do we feel that that's overstepping? Michael, is that what you're agreeing to, or are you agreeing to Paul? I'm not sure what your comment is directed to. Seems like I think the conversation chat is okay. You're agreeing with Paul on transliterations. Okay. And is also supportive of that change, as is Gigi. Is anyone not supportive of that change? Not seeing any objections to that. All right. Let's move on and look at number three. Whether and to what extent there is recognition of the recognition in the relevant sector of the public of the sign corresponding to the GTLD as the mark of the objector, including but not limited to niche market fame. Here, Paul has inserted the statement, including but not limited to niche market fame, and stricken the original language of the applicant or of a third party. So this seems to, change the direction of this item here. Do we have some thoughts from the membership on number three? Anyone object to the change in number three? Because people are typing. John does. All right. John doesn't understand it. Would anyone like to speak in support of the change? Do they understand the change, or is this something that we want to go put a marker down? Christina says we'll put a marker down on this one. The niche fame incorporates the dilution standard. The other parts effectively strike a fair use defense by the applicant. All right. Not fair use, competing legal rights. Got it. So we will put a marker down on this one. We will get confirm with Paul the rationale behind it, and then we will discuss this on the list. Anne notes that the issue is the definition of the relevant sector. It's hard to tie down. For example, are we talking about a household goods or industrial goods? Paul describes the possibility of a niche market, a narrow, not broad one, where a name or trademark is known to those in the markets. All right, we will put this one out to the list. Greg, I see your hand. Go ahead. Greg?
Hi, it's Greg again. Just briefly, there's a typo in the thing there. It should say including but not limited to niche market fame. That might help people understand a little bit better, at least just for, you know, pure English language uses. On the substance, I think that the issue of niche market fame is already kind of bundled into the recognition in the relevant sector concept. So I think it's already kind of there anyway, just being called out rather than being kind of added in, or perhaps it could be seen as clarifying that recognition in the relevant sector, you know, includes the concept of the famous or well-known mark, which is, you know, somewhat ambiguous. You say whether to what extent there is recognition. Does that mean recognition including the concept of fame or well-known or not? I would say it does, whether or not the language is in there, but putting the language in there clarifies that. Thanks.
Thanks, Greg. All right. We will make that grammatical change. Thanks for pointing that out. And get some more feedback on this one on the list. Moving down into number four, this section is putting some more onus on the applicant. The applicant in advance of the application would, under this, be required to have conducted a trademark search for the corresponding string. If the objection is based on common law rights, whether or not the applicant knew or should have known that the objector's mark, would be the proposed new standard. D, whether or not the applicant has engaged in past quote unquote private auctions designed to raise funds from competing applications. E, whether or not the applicant or any entity, officer, or board member of the applicant has been named in more than 5 UDRP complaints in the past 3 years or is the respondent in which the respondent was a losing party. So number four here is seeming to put a larger burden on the applicant than was in the previous round to do their due diligence and stay on the right side of the legal rights of others. Anyone want to speak to these changes? Have we seen any evidence of D, Michael Fleming asks. Well, I think we would have to look at, that would again be informed by the answer of when we asked Paul about the private auctions in the 2012 round. I guess we would see the 2012 round would be the past evidence that would be used in subsequent procedures. I don't think in 2012 rounds we had past evidence of private auctions. So I think it would just be a going forward thing. I don't think we could have had past evidence in 2012. John is questioning the relevance of a trademark search. again, I think that from the I would agree that probably majority of trademark dictionary terms are trademarked somewhere, but certainly they are, and IP holders would feel their rights should come before the dictionary, but I'll let Greg speak to that probably. Thanks. Go ahead, Greg.
Thanks. First, I'm not sure that I would agree that the majority of dictionary terms are trademarked somewhere. I think there are whole classes of words that generally don't get used in trademarks. The relevance of a trademark search, I think, you know, goes to idea of whether there's been an attempt to discern whether there's a trademark out there. That would raise an issue. I need to kind of think about the issue a little more. But there are, you know, certainly within trademark law, there are reasons to do trademark searches and certain negative assumptions that are taken if you commence use in a trademark fashion of something, of a string without doing a trademark search. So that you know, could go to the point here, but again, I can't really kind of off the top of my head say fully what was being thought here, but I think, you know, the underlying issue of whether a word in the dictionary or, what percentage of words in a dictionary are trademarks, I don't think that's necessarily relevant. The issue is whether the particular word is a trademark and what its relationship is to the string. We can get into the same types of issues with other types of legal rights besides trademarks. So I think that's I'm not sure whether we need to have a trademark search. I think we need to think about the issues. And, anybody who's done trademark searches has gotten back, voluminous books of examples, most of which you tend to reject as irrelevant because they tend to be overbroad in any case. So you end up focusing on a limited number of what comes up in the search anyway. So, most of them are basically chaff, and the job of the person analyzing the report is to figure out which ones are not. Thanks.
Thank you, Greg. Susan, go ahead.
Thanks. I'm not sort of advocating for this language in particular, but I do think at the moment it's unclear about what the knowledge and what this kind of trademark search, what the impact of doing it would be. And I think there's a confusion even, or people are debating it a little bit in the chat in any event. Is this making the assumption that if you've done a trademark search, you've therefore identified that there's a trademark, and consequently you've been using your trademark search effectively to identify a term to squat on, for want of a better word, or is this the notion that by not doing a trademark search, you've effectively proceeded without taking the proper, without conducting the proper checks and without the necessary diligence? I mean, I think it could go either way, and it's a very different outcome depending on which way one looks at this. So at the very least, if we were going to have language like this, which again, as I say, I'm not really advocating for, I think there needs to be complete clarity on what inference is supposed to get drawn by this, rather than leaving it to panels to decide what inference they're supposed to be drawing, because I think it could go either way. That said, I do think I do have some concerns about where are you supposed to do a trademark search. I mean, you can't just search the U.S. Are you supposed to do a worldwide trademark search? And what are you supposed to do with that information when you get hundreds or thousands of results back?
All very good points. Thank you, Susan. And as Susan noted, there is debate amongst the participants in the chat, so it does not seem that there is any clarity on this at all. And if this language is going to be changed, we're going to have to do some work on the list to draft something that is clear if we're going to change this from the way that it originally read. Moving on, as time is closing in on us, and we haven't looked at our second topic yet, let's quickly look at the rest of this document. Number 5, in the event that the string does not correspond to a famous trademark owned by the objector, Paul has inserted as a beginning of this section, whether and to what extent the applicant has used or has made demonstrable preparations to use the sign corresponding to the GTLD in connection with a bona fide offering of unrelated goods, unrelated here is an insertion, or services. So, again, Paul has restructured this to make it tied to unrelated goods and not corresponding to a famous trademark owned by the objector. So if I'm going to, at this point, because of time, I'm going to ask that we note in chat, unless you're not in chat, if you're on the phone, please do speak up. Questions for Paul on that section and note in chat objections to that or comments. Let's quickly look here at number six. In number six, Paul has added a significant amount of language, whereas at the end, it formally said the applicant is consistent with such acquisition or use. Paul changes that to strictly corresponds to the applicant's marks or other intellectual property rights. Failure of the applicant to include registration and use restrictions prohibiting registration and use of the string in conjunction with the goods and services covered by the objector's trademark shall be conclusive evidence that the applicant does not have defenses under this paragraph. So, again, this is making the applicant very much responsible for preserving the legal rights of others. Any comments, objections to this section, please raise them at this time. Anyone wish to speak? Christina is typing. All right, while Christina is typing, we will look at number seven. Which Paul has proposed striking. Number seven had originally said whether and to what extent the applicant has been commonly known by the sign corresponding to the GTLD, and if so, whether any purported or likely use of the GTLD by the applicant is consistent therewith and bona fide. Paul has said deleting this, that this can be gamed with mere corporate filings. The issue is trademarks and not corporate names. Do we have support for deleting this section? Do we have opposition to deleting this section? Kurt and Christina are typing. And last, while they are typing, we will look at number eight. The applicant's intended use of the GTLD would create a likelihood of confusion with the objector's mark as to the source of sponsorship, affiliation, or endorsement with the GTLD. Failure of the applicant to include registration and use restrictions prohibiting registration and use of the string in conjunction with the goods and services covered by the objector's trademark shall be conclusive evidence that the applicant's intended use of the GTLD would create a likelihood of confusion with the objector's mark as to the source of the sponsorship, affiliation, or endorsement with the GTLD. This is similar to number six. So we can pair eight and six together with the conclusive proof concept. Comments on this? Anne, please, go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Karen. It's Anne for the transcript. I actually had a comment in relation to the deletion of seven. I think the deletion of seven is problematic because I believe that there are some trademark rights that are protected by statute, rather than being, there being a, you know, a requirement that they be registered. And so, you know, we could look into the history as to why seven exists, but I think the deletion of seven is a little problematic, given that, that some name rights are protected by statute and even by treaties for certain governments. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. And I note several other people in the chat, Kurt and Christina, have also commented to the effect that they believe that Section 7 had validity. All right. And then with regard to the corporate names. Christina has noted that some countries afford corporate name trademark-like protection. Okay. Anne, is hand still to comment further, or is that your hand on what you just said?
Sorry, trying to get it down. Sorry.
Okay, no problem. All right, we are closing in on 2 minutes. Does anyone else want to add anything to the record before we close out today? We've got quite a list. Paul is going to get quite an email. I'm going to make sure he draw his attention to it, but we're going to post it to the entire list to solicit everybody's feedback. What I'm going to ask us to do in an effort to somewhat keep us to our timeline is please take a look at the string proposal from the registries that was circulated again over a year ago. We had some discussion on it. It wasn't nearly as contentious back then. Now we've had new members join and a lot has happened in a year. But take a look at that, please, in the next day or two, if you can, while it's fresh, and put your comments on the list, comments, questions, concerns with that on the list, and let's keep this going. Registries, just as an observation, the proposal by the registry seems to address a lot of the comments that came in CC 1 and 2 from various constituencies. So I think it's at least a good jumping off point for us. So I would ask you to do that. Also, we're going to be, more to let you know, probably on the list shortly you'll be seeing some write-ups to review with regard to communities. We finished our meeting discussions on communities. We're going to start turn that to paper. We have received a formal request from the GAC to have a written summary to them prior to the meeting in Puerto Rico of the status of discussions on communities, community priority evaluation, and community-based applications. So as the leadership starts to write that up with staff, where we'll be circulating that to the group as well. So look for that in your mailboxes. Please provide input and help us with that too. Our next call will be in 2 weeks. Robin will be leading that, and we will be continuing with the rest of our objection topics. Thank you, everybody. Appreciate it. And have a great rest of your day.
Thanks, Karen. Thanks, everyone. Bye for now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And once again, the meeting has been adjourned. Thank you very much for joining. Please remember to disconnect all remaining lines and have a wonderful rest of your day.